Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Welcome to this week's episode of Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name's Kirk Chisholm, and I'm going to be your host. Today, we have Andrew Stotz from the podcast, My Worst Investment Ever. I'm really excited about this because not only do we have Andrew on, but the second half of our show, we have live coming from FinCon, where we ask a bunch of personal finance professionals about their worst investment ever. Before we begin, let's talk about Betterment. Are you looking for a better way to invest during market turmoil? Consider Betterment. Betterment is a robo-advisor that uses time-tested principles and modern portfolio theory to help you manage your wealth and reach your financial goals. With Betterment, you don't have to worry about what the market's doing on a day-to-day basis. Instead, Betterment allows you to use the stock market to consistently build wealth. For more information, visit moneytreepodcast.com/Betterment. A lot of investors use Betterment, but it doesn't mean it's the right fit for you. Do your own research. Check out moneytreepodcast.com/Betterment to see if Betterment is the right fit for you. So today we have Andrew Stotz on the show. Andrew, how are you doing today?
I am great and happy to be here.
Awesome. Well, I am happy to have you here as well. Why don't you tell the listeners a little about yourself? You've got a great podcast called My Worst Investment Ever. Tell us a little about yourself.
I studied undergrad at Cal State Long Beach, and then I got fascinated with Asia. And when I was 26 years old, I moved to Thailand, and I have lived in Thailand for 28 years. I built a career in finance here, and I was involved with CFA here, for those of our listeners who know CFA. I love the world of investing, and I have my own research company here in Asia. And I think what I would just mention is that on April 13th in 2018, I sent out an email to friends and clients and others, and I told the people that I was going to teach some university students, which I've taught now for 28 years, how to reduce investment risk, and would they mind telling me a story of their worst investment ever? To that email, I got 500 replies of 500 written stories of loss, and that is why and where and when I started my podcast, My Worst Investment Ever.
That's phenomenal. One of the reasons I do this podcast is because, you know, I enjoy the stories. I enjoy listening to them. I enjoy doing them. I think the stories is what drives us as human beings. And I love the fact that you've got that kind of response, because that's how we learn. We all learn from other people's mistakes. We learn from other people's stories. You know, if you're smart, you learn from other people's stories. If you're not so smart, you learn from your own mistakes. But
yeah, well, Kirk, I think another key part of that is that stories are things that we can remember. How many times have we heard a good story and then we go tell our friends, oh my God, you should have heard what this guy told me. And so I think that there's even an added component that it's something that we can actually remember when that moment comes in our own life to think, oh, wait a minute. This is quite similar to a story I heard about a person, you know, losing. So the stories are valuable in many different ways, but one of them is it certainly helps us remember.
Yeah, and we just finished taping an episode on Andrew's podcast where I was a guest on his show, and I highly recommend everybody listen to it because it was a phenomenal episode. And the show, I think, is one of the reasons why we did this episode is not only to talk about worst investments, but also to, you know, learn from experts as to how you prevent making them yourself. So, Andrew, I want to ask, because you run this podcast, you obviously have a ton of stories, and I'm sure you have a lot to choose from, but what one worst investment would you want to talk about that you think is a really good lesson for the listeners? It could be yours, could be somebody else's story, but give us your best story that you know.
Let me give you some background before I tell you the story. Basically, when I got those 500 stories of loss, I took about 100 of them and I classified them in different groupings to try to think about where were these mistakes. And then from the other more than 100 interviews that I've done, I also classified those. I mean, ultimately, I'm an analyst, so I was analyzing the data. And then from that, I basically identified 6 common mistakes. But the number one, most common of all, is what I call failed to do their research. And I just want to tell you a story about a guy from Alabama, Josiah. And his episode was great because he was flipping houses, basically. And he had just started this business with his friend. And they decided to buy this particular house. But he made a key mistake. He didn't get outside assessors. He didn't get all the different due diligence checks that he should have done. And he just didn't do his research. Also, he got excited about this one particular house, forgetting that it's in a particular part of the city and all of that. When he bought it, he basically started to see, okay, there's termite damage that he didn't notice. There were other things that he didn't notice. But the best part of the story was when he walked in the backyard, he noticed that there's these indentations and holes in the backyard that he hadn't noticed. And he had to get a wildlife person to come out and look at it. And what they found was that, in fact, the house was infested with armadillos. If you can imagine, as he said, there were some massive armadillos. They had to set up these armadillo traps, and he was just blown away at how many armadillos they captured in these traps that then the guy moved to, you know, the wilderness. But all the cost and research, you know, he could have done the research, but he didn't. So then he had to get rid of the armadillos. So a lot of cost there. And then he brought his first guest to the house after that. And what happened was when they walked up to the house was swarming with hornets. And it turns out the armadillos, of course, were eating the hornets underground. And so, and for those of you that have watched the movie The Money Pit, it just went on and on. But it ends, the whole story ends with the hilarious situation where they're 3 hours away from finally closing after 10 different things that popped up because he failed to do his research. And he has the chimney guy cleaning out the chimney. And at the last minute, the chimney guy decides, well, why don't I take my vacuum and I'm just going to vacuum out any last bits of black soot that's in this chimney. And it turns out that the chimney guy had the vacuum on in reverse, and he blew the black soot from the chimney all over the living room. Oh. And they had to rush to paint the walls, clean the whole living room in 3 hours. Finally, the buyer arrived. They had cleaned it up enough. They signed a deal and he got rid of it. But what the lesson that he taught us all in that episode was, do your research. And as I say, what's a strategy to win in that case? Take the time to write down your investment options and potential gains. Take the time to write it down and do your research.
Yeah, that is a great lesson. And that's something we talk about all the time on the show, is do your own research. Don't just listen to a friend or a coworker or a hot tip you heard from, you know, from your golfing buddy. That's not how you do real research. I love this story. This is great. I think that, you know, the best experience comes from the worst experience. Obviously, it's best to learn from other people's experiences so you don't have to make your own. But that's a great topic. And I think one thing that if we can pull this anything away from the show, it's this. I mean, if you look at why people like Bernie Madoff were able to get away with their fraud as long as they did, it's because no one was doing the research. I mean, when I say no one, obviously there were a handful of people, but generally speaking, all the investors, they weren't doing the research. They were just assuming, oh, he's reputable. Sure, I'll put my money with him. And I think it's a dying art on Wall Street to people actually doing the research?
Yeah, well, many people aren't paying for it. And we see in Asia and in Europe with MiFID II and other changes that are happening in the industry, basically the dollars that are being spent on research are being cut pretty dramatically. So yeah, it is very important. And oh man, I really want to tell you the story of common mistake number two, the second most common mistake, which is failed to properly assess and manage risk. You want to hear that story?
Absolutely. Love to.
I want to introduce you to Jeremy Newsom. He's in Canada. And basically he saw a movie where a guy got rich investing in a fruit company. It was Forrest Gump, and he had invested. Lieutenant Dan had invested in Apple stock. So he got all excited, and he got a little bit of money from his dad. And you know, his dad matched some of the money that he was able to raise from going out and selling. Actually, he sold blackberries at the time, which he said, not the device, but the actual berries, to get the cash to match with his father's money. And they probably had $1,000 or $2,000, and they invested in the stock market. And luckily for Jeremy and his dad, they did very well. But then after that, he got confident and overconfident. And what he decided, he got excited and into the hype about the silver, the price of silver, which was rising pretty dramatically. He convinced his dad to give him some more money to invest in the stock market. And basically what happened was he bought, as he says, I bought silver 15 minutes before its all-time peak.
Wow.
And so then what happened was silver collapsed within a week by about 20%. Well, that's already painful enough, but it gets worse because he didn't actually buy silver. He bought a call option on silver or a derivative instrument, which basically meant that his money actually went to zero. So in 1 week, he lost 100% of his second investment that he made. That's already pretty brutal. And it's a great illustration of the fact that he just did not have any systems in place to manage risk. But the thing that really made the story more painful was that it turns out that the money his father had given him, given the confidence that they both had, was 100% of his retirement savings.
Wow. That's painful. I remember that time period because we were actually trading silver. And I remember those call options are really expensive. We were selling puts all the way up with silver, and you were making some good premiums there, but it was really expensive to hedge your risk there at the top. So I can empathize that. That was, I mean, options are, you should probably have that in one of your big ways. Options are a very dangerous thing if you don't know what you're doing.
Exactly. And what I try to tell people is, you know, a way to mitigate this risk or a strategy to win is to try to rank each risk by probability and severity and create a risk reduction plan. And I like to, one of my guests taught me, you know, the lesson I took from it, I wrote down OD and WP. And in his case, OD, in my case, was telling me that overcome overconfidence, that's the O, through diversification. And in his case, overcome the idea that you could be wrong by buying a protective put. So, you know, here are two main causes of risk, of being overconfident and of just being wrong. And he gave two specific ones. This was not Jeremy, but Jeremy now is a very experienced trader and has many risk management in methodologies in place. So I would say out of all the different stories that I've heard, the number one mistake is they failed to do their own research. And number two is that they failed to properly assess and manage their risk.
Yeah. And I think that's an important point because I, you know, we talk about this a little bit on the show and I think we need to talk about it more because options is a really, I guess I'd call it like a sexy topic, right? It's the shiny object. Everybody's like, oh, I made 100, 200, 300% on my options trade. And it's like, yeah, but if you did it right, then that should have been a very, very small position size. And what people don't realize is options were not created to speculate. They were creating to manage risk. While people can use them to speculate, there's nothing wrong with that. You have to do it in the same way that you manage your equity exposure. You have to know what your risks are. You have to manage them. You have to understand how to allocate properly. Because I don't know any options investors that put 100% of their money into options positions because that's not the intention. Because you'd be highly leveraged at that point. So I love this story. I think, you know, it's something that more people need to understand. I mean, options have two sides to it. There is a beneficial side. And then, of course, there's the hazard, which primarily is if you don't know what you're doing. Because if you know what you're doing, options are one of the best instruments out there to use. Because you can clearly define your risk and outcome. There's no other instrument out there that you could say, I think the stock's going to go up a little bit, then sideways, then down, then up again. Like you could clearly define a strategy around options if you have a certain path you think it's going to take. So it's really great, but it does require a lot of reading and research to really understand them.
Yeah. Well, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I want to hear some more stories.
I can bring you to point number three. Now we have six main lessons that we learned of six ways to lose your money. And I can introduce you to a man. His name is Jim and his last name is Ponwanit. And Jim is in Bangkok, Thailand, in fact. And basically he had done well after the 2008 crash. He had invested at the right time, put his money in. And by 2015, he decided it's time to cash out of those gains. And he became obsessed with the idea of investing in volatility. And remember also that this story is about being driven by emotion or flawed thinking. That is common mistake number three. So he started to do research about how he could put his money into this, you know, trading volatility. And he, you know, found exchange traded notes, and he found the ones that he wanted to invest in. And he had a lot of confidence in what, in the research. So he was doing research and he was reading a lot of research. He was doing a lot of thinking in this. And once he got confident in it, he invested 50% of his money, convinced that volatility had found a bottom. And really, it was supported by his research. But after 4 months, that investment went down by 40%. And at that time, wow, he basically did more research. And, you know, he saw the competing researches out there. But after doing more research and having lost 40% of his money, he decided to take the other 50% he had not invested and put it in.
Oof.
So by the time he sold his position, he gave up and he lost 70% of all the money he had generated from the time he invested in the market originally in 2008, which was, you know, a huge amount of his own personal wealth. So basically what we can learn from that is the idea that it's not enough that we just do good research. And also, of course, there's mistakes here related to risk management. We know that you need to size your positions much better than this type. But also we have to think about the idea is that we need to find, explore, and write out opposing views. We need to discuss them with a knowledgeable person. We need to find maybe someone objective. Or sometimes what can happen is we can get caught up in our own flawed emotions or thinking. And Jim gives us a great example of that. And so that's a good lesson from what we learned from that story.
I think it's a great point, and we talked about this on your podcast as well, is it's really important to seek out opposing views. We have this thing called confirmation bias. We all have it as human beings, and we're constantly seeking out other people to confirm that we're right. So nobody wants to be proven wrong. We all want to be right. And so you think about politics, and we never talk about politics in the show, but just conceptually, there are people on the right, there are people on the left. People on the right are looking for people of similar mindset to confirm that what they're thinking is correct. People on the left do the same thing. And what I would say almost everybody does is they look for the confirming views. They're never looking for the other side to see what the other side is saying. And with investing, you know, with politics, it probably doesn't matter, but with investing, it really does. And if you're not looking for why you're wrong, then you're not getting better and you're not improving as an investor. And I think that's a really important point because we're all driven by emotions. And if you're not looking for how you can be wrong, then you're doing yourself a disservice, right?
That's the beauty of investing is that, you know, we really, to be successful, you really have to challenge yourself. By the way, number four of the six common ways that people lose their money is misplaced trust. Would you like to hear a story about that?
I would love to.
I want to introduce you to a guy. His name is Azran, and he is from Malaysia. A really, really interesting guy. Basically, he pioneered the long-haul, low-cost airline model, and he founded a company. He was the founding CEO of a company called AirAsia X. And he took this company from zero startup to $1 billion and 2,500 staff and an IPO. And he did all of that in 6 years. Pretty impressive guy. Now, the guy that was his ultimate shareholder is even more impressive, Tony Fernandez, who founded AirAsia. And basically, when Azran started the company, Tony basically said that he didn't believe in stock options for executives. He felt like there wasn't a lot of, that the executives weren't sharing in the downside. And so he wanted Azran to invest his own wealth instead of getting stock options. Well, Azran wasn't like a rich guy, but he took 100% of his wealth. And basically, Tony said, that's not enough. So with the help of banks, he managed to get loans. And he went all in and he borrowed as much money as he could and he became a serious shareholder in the company. And he still, you know, to this day, despite some of the mistakes here, he still believes in the idea of skin in the game, for sure. But in this case, of course, he was massively overexposed to this one situation, this one asset. Well, the good news is that they did an IPO. So he made it to IPO. Now, what next happened was that he got advice from investment bankers who said, hey, why don't you take those shares and put them down as collateral and we can lend you more money and then you can buy the shares at IPO price. And you know, all of the buyers of the IPO is really going to appreciate it if the CEO is putting more money in at that price. Well, he did that. So now he has massive amount of personal loans out, you know, himself. Good news, it all worked out because at the time of the IPO, he had earned a 6x return on his money. But there's two little words that come out after that, which is on paper. So in 2014, the management team had taken the $300 million of the IPO proceeds and they doubled down on building out a massive fleet of planes. They also doubled down on a strategy to go into China and Australia and say 70% of their revenue is going to come from there. But in 2014, tragedy struck. There were three airlines disasters in that 1 year, two of them with Malaysia Airlines, and then one of them was an Air Asia domestic flight, a flight from Indonesia to Singapore. Tragedy, disaster, and everything got wiped out. Basically, in the end, the value of the shares collapsed. And of course, he ended up losing his job and he had to resign through all of this struggle. And in the end, he had a personal 7-digit US dollar cash loss and basically just completely wiped him out. And the lesson that I learned from that is the idea of be careful who you trust. In this case, if he had not had taken on all that personal debt, it's possible that he could have exited this situation and not have been his worst investment ever. But he trusted the people that were advising him. And I also oftentimes, as an analyst visiting CEOs around Asia, I always tell them, you know, never make the mistake of listening to analysts and listening to investment bankers, you know, or doing what they say. It's fine to listen, but be very careful because in the end, the lesson that we can learn is that those investment bankers are making fees no matter what happens. So that was about misplaced trust and some other things related to risk.
Yeah. And I think that's a great story. And I think one of the things that I take away from that is something that I learned from investing with options. It's harder to learn this lesson with equities because the performance ends up working slower. But with options, one of our risk management tools is if you make 100% returns on the investment, you sell half of it, you take your principal out, and you're basically playing with the house's money at that point. And whether you decide to keep it and let it run or close it out, but anytime it goes up 100%, we always sell half. Because at the end of the day, you can get greedy and you can say, oh, I sold half initially, so I didn't make as much money as I could have if I held on. But if you're taking your principal out, your probability of loss is zero. That way, you can be really comfortable about the future price appreciation or what have you. So I love this story because it really talks about the idea of, and this is a little different because as a CEO, you kind of have some expectations, right? You can't just trade the stock back and forth. There's some buy-in that has to be there. But obviously, putting all your eggs in one basket, trusting people, you know, all of that comes with risk. If people are a little bit more mindful of their emotions, this goes back to the third one of, you know, do I need to be taking these kind of risks or should I be securing my wealth a little bit more so I'm not so leveraged? So I love this story. This is great.
Yeah. I mean, the great thing about my worst investment ever I've found is that everybody has a story. It doesn't have to be a professional investor. We can learn from all stories. In fact, when I came up with the idea, my 81-year-old mother said, I got a story to tell you about your father's and my worst investment ever, how we lost $5,000 by betting on some particular stock and all that. So now I'm almost done. I'm at number 5, which is failed to monitor their investment. And I can introduce you to a very short story by a esteemed man named David Stein. Would you like to hear that?
I would, actually, because I know a David Stein. He was on the show here recently, so I hope it's not the same one. Or maybe it is.
I believe it probably is. Money for the Rest of Us. A very wise man with a lot of depth of experience. And this is also what's valuable about the show, is that it is a brave souls that come on and tell their story. But what David, you know, got when he retired from his full-time job as strategist and working in fund management, he went to visit a hedge fund office. And when he went to visit that hedge fund office, he was seduced by the buzz. I mean, it was fantastic. The trading floor was just rocking. And he decided that he wanted to become a trader. Basically, what he did is he started, you know, did a lot of study, and then he started to do some trades. And very quickly, he realized, oh my goodness, this is not really for me. It's not my style. The skill set that I need here is not what I have. And I'm not interested in learning that to the depth that's needed to be successful. So I always use this story as a way to tell the young people that say, oh, I'm going to start trading in Forex, or I'm going to start trading in XYZ. And I think if David can't make a success out of it, be very careful. David very wisely, you know, in his case, and I think the other message from this story is, do what suits your personality. If trading really fits your personality and you want to build a competitive advantage in it, do it. But basically what happened was that he had stopped doing all that trading, but he had forgotten to close a trade that he had set to automatically buy silver when it fell to a certain price. We got a silver theme here. Basically, the price kept falling, and then eventually it hit that price, and he lost about $25,000 in this particular trade. And as he said, you know, what made the loss even worse is that, you know, I should have known better. But the point is that there just are times that people are not monitoring their investments. And whether that's, you know, someone saying, oh, I invested in a restaurant my friend wanted to set up, and, you know, you haven't followed it up. You gave him $100,000, but, you know, you're not monthly checking on it or anything like that. So it's very, very important that we monitor our investment. So what I say that I learned from David is, you know, once you've invested, follow a regular predetermined monitoring process. Once a month, spend 10 minutes, whatever it is, to make sure that you're monitoring your investments.
I think that's a great point. I actually want to pull a little side story out of your story too, when you're talking about David understood his investment style and that wasn't it. That's something I like to talk about on the show, because I find it to be really important. A lot of people, you know, they read Warren Buffett and they say, I want to be like Warren Buffett or Carl Icahn or David Einhorn or Seth Klarin. And you have all these really successful investors and they're like, I'm going to invest like them. Well, maybe you shouldn't invest like them, because, you know, like David saw, there are people who are good traders. I know some. They make really, really good returns every single year consistently. But that's more along their mindset. That's more along with their investor suitability, if you will. Suitability is probably the wrong word, but it's along the lines with their psychology, their investor psychology. So some people are traders. I'm not built to trade, because for me, sitting around all day in front of a computer screen is monotonous and I drive myself crazy. Some people are really good. They're very disciplined. They're very good with their systems, as you're talking about, and this may be good for them. So for me, I found that options work really well for me, because I know what my weaknesses are. I have some very distinct weaknesses, which I know, and I have a lot of strengths. So what I do is I support my weaknesses by finding systems or investing strategies that help defend against those weaknesses. And one of my weaknesses, I'll tell you, is stop losses. There was a time in 2011 where I think the market went up or down 10% each way, like 20 times in that year. So everyone who had a stop loss was getting stopped out, and you just end up losing money even though the market wasn't moving directionally in anywhere but sideways. So I realized really quickly that I'm not good at that part, but options allowed me to defend against that weakness. So I never had to stop out, because I was still in the option. I was still in the trade. So I can buy and hold it, as opposed to selling it out and closing the position. And that's one example for me, and other people have found other ways too. Like Warren Buffett, I mean, you probably know this pretty well, but his secret to his success is not necessarily his investments. That's only part of it. The other part is the insurance company, which most people don't talk about, but that's where he made his big money, was, you know, running an insurance company, a property casualty and a reinsurance. You can't do that. I can't do that. You know, we could invest in the same companies, but it's too late. They've made their gains that they've made. So I think we all have to realize you have to find what makes sense for you. And I appreciate that story for that point among, obviously, the monitoring.
Yeah, be the best you that you can be. Exactly. That's really our objective in life, I would say. Now, I want to wrap it up with the number six most common ways that people lose their money. And this one is slightly different. I just really couldn't figure out how to classify it. So I just decided to create its own category all unto itself. And that is invested in a startup company. I want to tell you the story of Viola Llewellyn, a powerful, impressive woman who came up with the idea of an app and a system of how she could raise money and get funding to small and medium-sized businesses in Africa. What an opportunity, what a need. She went out and traveled all around and found many small and medium-sized businesses that needed funding and they couldn't get it from the traditional methods. And then she went all around talking about what she was doing. And really, it was a great idea. She got a lot of people interested and she found a big investor. This investor was going to put in $12 million. And at the end, she waited for that money to come in. And in the end, something had changed in the management of that particular investment company. And they told her, we're not putting in the money. And she had to go back and it was, you know, too late. They later pivoted and they did something else, but she had to go back to many small and medium-sized business people in Africa to tell them all the hopes and dreams that she had really got excited about and got them excited about just went up in a puff of smoke. And it was so hard and emotionally painful for her, that it also reminds us in the case of small business, the thing that I say as one of the strategies to win is just remember, when investing in a startup, the odds are you will lose everything. And startups are oftentimes very binary. You're either going to make it or you're not. And when you don't, there's nothing to recover from the startup.
It's a great point you're making, because I think a lot of people go in with hopes and dreams and they don't go in thinking, I'm going to lose everything. And I think if you go in, just like you're saying, I think it's a great point, because most people go in thinking they're going to invest in the next Google, or else why would you invest? Everybody thinks that, right? But if they go in thinking this is going to go to zero and I'm okay with that, then that's different, right? I mean, you're talking about the story from the perspective of somebody running the company, which is, as an entrepreneur, you've got a whole nother level up there of risks and rewards and all of that. But as an investor, I know a lot of people invest in startups, private equity, companies like that, venture capital. And I think if you go in with the mindset that it's probably going to go to zero, then everything else is gravy after that.
There it is. And those are the six most common mistakes that I've gotten out of it. And, I would wrap up my discussion about that by, I'd like to read the opening to my podcast for your listeners. And it is, hello, fellow risk takers, and welcome to my worst investment ever. Stories of loss to keep you winning. In our community, we know that to win in investing, you must take risk, but to win big, you've got to reduce it.
Awesome. Andrew, love having you on the show. Where can people find out more about you and your podcast?
Just go to myworstinvestmentever.com and share in the stories that so many people, brave people like yourself, are sharing, and come and learn.
Great. Well, I put my tapestry on his wall as well. So if you want to hear about my worst investment, you can certainly go to that show. Andrew, thanks a lot for coming on. This has been fantastic. And we're going to be shortly going over to our live part of the episode where we're going to be at FinCon. So thanks for coming on, Andrew. We're definitely going to have you on again.
Thanks, Kirk. My pleasure.
Have you ever heard a radio ad and thought, wow, what a great idea? I really want to give all my money to a random stranger that I heard on the radio. Hey, you can't say that. Why not? People do it every day. Sure they do. But why are you pointing it out? Well, because some people never learn that lesson of not talking to strangers. This is a public service announcement. If you hear a radio ad that promises you 100% of return of gains with little or no risk, if you hear an ad that promises you easy money, or if it sounds too good to be true, well, it probably is. Do your own research or hire a professional. Either way, your money is way too important to your future to make hasty decisions. If you're experienced enough to do your own research, please spend the time. If you're not that experienced to do your own research, hire a professional. Someone experienced in providing investment due diligence, someone who is unbiased, and someone who's going to put your interest above their own. But if you don't know one of those people, you're in luck. Some of them are on this show as hosts and guests. Check us out each week to learn how to invest and protect your wealth. Oh, and remember to sign up for our new free report, The Top 10 Investing Myths That You Know to Be True But Aren't. This report is going to blow your mind. Go to moneytreepodcast.com/myths. Once again, that's www.moneytreepodcast.com/myths. Thanks again for listening, and remember to invest in your life. We have a very special podcast this week. We're recording live from FinCon at the NEFI podcasting stage. So this week we have Miranda Marquit, we all know.
Heyo! So excited to be at FinCon and recording, and in person. It's so fun to record in person.
Oh, yeah. This is awesome. I get to see all my co-hosts this week, so this is going to be a little weird.
It's good, though. Good, though.
Yeah. We also have David Outen. David, how are you doing today?
Pretty good.
Awesome. Well, this episode, we're going to have a little special episode where we're going to be talking about the worst investments that you've had. And this is going to be exciting. I think we all have those terrible investments that are really deserve to be up in the ranks with the Titanic. And we actually, because we're at a conference, we're bringing a lot of people who are here at the conference to talk about their worst investments. So actually, we have, first one up, we have Ricardo. Ricardo, how are you doing today?
How's it going, Kirk? Very good, man.
Oh, this is great. Glad to have you.
Well, tell us where you're from, first of all.
Yeah, so my name is Ricardo. I'm the co-founder of MyFintech, which is My Financial Architect. And we're a lifestyle-driven financial planning coaching company for millennials. We're located out of Miami, although we provide our services nationwide.
All right, cool. Awesome. So tell us, what is your, what's the worst investment?
So the moment I saw that you guys were going to do these questions, I'm like, I have to go talk to them because my background is finance. So I come from like the traditional, you know, investment world and banking world.
Broker.
And say it again.
Were you a broker?
I was not a broker. I was more a commercial banker.
Oh,
but
gotcha,
I was
gotcha.
Very well surrounded. I know. We can edit that part later.
There's good ones and bad ones everywhere. Right,
but definitely we're all in the world of investments, and we do good ones and bad ones. And just to share one, it's when the whole Bitcoin hype started, right? I mean, nice. I think a lot of people can relate to this message. And we were actually right before the Bitcoin hype, we were trying to get into some real estate rehabbing opportunity, and we lost the contract on the property that we put an offer on. So we were like, okay, so what do we do with this money? You know, kind of like thinking short term, flipping it. Something like that. And then people were talking about Bitcoin. So we're like, you know what? We'll give it a try. So it's one of those investments that we're not taking like our life savings or like all of our money and hoping that we're going to become like the next Warren Buffett of Bitcoin, right? Yeah. But pretty much it was just money that we're like, okay, we're going to risk it. And the crazy thing is that Bitcoin went all the way up right from that moment. So we invested, I want to say like about $15,000. It grew to about $130,000.
Oh, wow.
And the funny thing is that we said, look, if it ever gets to $100,000, we're going to cash out, right? But you get in the moment, right? And then you forget about the fundamentals. And it got to $100,000. And we're like, yeah, what if it gets to $110,000? And then at one time, we're like, what if it gets to $120,000? Crazy thing is that right when it got to $130,000, it plummeted.
Oh,
it
yeah.
Crashed.
It went all, yep, it yep. crashed. Yep. So we went from 130, 120, 110, 90, 80, 70, 60, 50, all the way back to where we were able to cash out at about 30, 40,000. So we still made some money out of it, but you know, going back to not understanding investments or just doing things because everybody else is doing it or just talking about it can definitely lose some money. And then on top of that, I do know a lot of those people that started talking to me about Bitcoin actually lost money.
Yeah,
from
yeah.
the investment. And I'm talking like hundreds of thousands of dollars, and people pulling money out of lines of credits and home equity loans and just hoping that that was going to be the next big thing.
Yeah, and one of the things also that really struck me as you were telling the story, Ricardo, is that you talked about, oh, we're going to sell at this point. And then you kept trying to, like, you know, run your profits rather than taking your profits. And so, you know, when you're doing things like this, especially if you're doing something that's kind of speculative, I think it really helps to remember you take your profits, you know, have that discipline,
yep,
you know.
Exactly. Right. And that's what I was going to say. Like, one of the fundamentals for me coming from the finance background is exactly that. If you have the profit, just cash it and get out. So you got to be careful, definitely, with the speculative type of investments.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks a lot, Ricardo.
Thank you, Ricardo, for joining us.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah,
it was a pleasure.
Your story.
All right. So do we have somebody else who's next?
Yeah, Mindy.
We're so happy to have you today, Mindy.
I'm so excited to be here. I love FinCon, and I love talking to you guys.
Yeah, so tell us about where you come from.
I come from BiggerPockets.com, the real estate investing social network. So, spoiler alert, I'm going to talk about real estate again.
Surprise, surprise.
Good, we're happy with that. So tell us about your worst investment.
My worst investment was a live-in flip, which is the way that I invest in real estate. I buy an ugly house, I move into it, I fix it up while I'm living there. There are tax benefits to this. I pay no capital gains taxes on the improvement or the appreciation up to $500,000 because I'm married, or you would get $250,000 if you're single. So I bought this house in September of 2006. I don't know if anybody knows what happened in like 2007, 2008 with the housing market. It softened a little.
I got a little scared about my job.
got a little soft.
Yeah, the housing market softened just a touch to like liquid butter or something. And I was pregnant at the time. I had a baby in February of 2007. And this was my $1 million flip. It was located on a lake in Madison, Wisconsin. It was a significantly higher price point than the surrounding non-lake properties. And there's, you know, very little on the lake and a whole lot off the lake. So I bought with a limited audience to buy it when I was done with my flip. I bought it the worst possible time ever. I put in a lot of money, some of it twice, because I hired bad contractors.
Oh, no.
Really bad contractors. They were stealing from me, so that's a bonus. I ended up doing the back of the house windows twice. They didn't put any insulation around it or flashing or something, flashing, I think, or tape or whatever that caused. So we faced the lake. All this wind came off the lake in the wintertime, and there was literally nothing stopping the wind between the walls and the window. There was just this giant crack around every window, so at least they were consistent. My $1 million flip turned into a $700,000 flip, so I thought I was going to sell it for $1 million, and I ended up selling it, I think, $725 or $750.
But how much did you put in?
Oh, so much. This is my worst investment because it was supposed to pay off really well, and it didn't. I didn't lose money, but instead of making, you know, $400,000, I made $100,000. And when you're putting all of these finishes into it, you know, oh, I could go nicer because it's on the lake and it's going to make me not $1 million, but I was really hoping I was going to hit that $500,000 ceiling, and I did not.
Bummer.
Wow. We made something great out of what could have been a terrible situation, Mindy. So it sounds like anybody wants to invest with Mindy, it sounds like you're the person to go to if that's your worst investment.
And why is it that you're a BiggerPockets?
Because I know everything. Yay. No.
Mindy's life has changed completely since then, huh? Right.
It has. I was a stay-at-home mom then, and now I'm not. But my girls are older. They're in school. This house had a lot of problems, and every day we would wake up and there was like another problem. And I remember at one point I came downstairs to the basement and there was this huge bubble in the paint, and it was right outside a faucet. So I knew that something was leaking, and I'm like, I am done. I quit. I'm going to burn this house down. I don't care anymore. I can't take another thing. And then we figured out that it was like the faucet had leaked. We thought a pipe was burst, but it was just a faucet that was leaking. So it was actually a relatively easy repair. But like that was the moment I almost left real estate forever.
Well, you felt like Shelley Long in Money Pit, right?
Oh my God, that's a horrible
thing. I just aged myself right there.
Hey, we've all seen it. So
yeah, right, yeah, no
right there with
on
you.
That one. Awesome.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks
Thank
for coming
you.
By, Mindy. All right, Kevin. Kevin, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you?
Good. So tell us about you, Kevin. Where are you from?
I'm from New Jersey.
Yeah, what do you do?
I work full-time as a health safety environmental engineer, so I deal with compliance with OSHA, EPA, and the rest of the alphabet soup of government regulatory agencies.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah, it's very boring.
Also, it looks like you have a website.
Well, not yet. I got the name figured out, and I'll put it online in time. Just not yet, because I don't have enough time. But if you guys are familiar with You Need a Budget, I run the YNAB Fans Group on Facebook. We're at 44,000 people and growing.
Oh, nice. Nice.
Very nice.
Awesome. So tell us about your worst investment.
My worst investment. So I was 19 and did the typical thing and bought a brand new car. So $400 a month payments, $29,500 out the door. And because of that, I was unable to contribute to Roth IRA for about 3.5 years. So total of 17,000 contributions I missed out on. And well, that compounds to like over 600,000 by the time I hit traditional retirement age. So it's a lot of money.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. I really like your story because it's not like this dramatic tale of woe. Instead, it's like a cautionary tale about like opportunity cost and what happens when you're not taking advantage of time and compounding. So thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I made out on it all right in the end because it was a Jetta TDI that got wrapped up under the whole Dieselgate scandal for Volkswagen. So they did buy it back for a total of $16,150. Oh, and gosh. I had it for 8 years and 110,000 miles. And when I turned it in, it needed about $3,000 worth of maintenance that I didn't do. Because
right.
Their only requirement was that it drive onto the trailer under its own power. So
nice.
I made out okay, but the opportunity cost still killed me.
Yeah, yeah.
That was
sure.
The only requirement? So did it have any seats or any interior
things that were still there? As crazy as it sounds, the woman I talked to from Volkswagen when she was there said that was it. They had people actually parting the cars out and selling interior components to other people before turning them in. And whether it was crashed up or whatever, as long as it could drive,
wow,
that's all that mattered. And when I turned mine in, it had the factory brakes, rotors, factory battery.
Nice.
All four tires were bald, cords showing on one, and the battery wouldn't last more than 12 hours unless you started it every so often. So
that's fantastic.
That
so you learned
awesome.
Two lessons here, opportunity costs and to maintain your car, right?
Well, once they said I didn't need to do any maintenance on the rest of it, I just drug it out as long as possible because I didn't want to sink money into it when I was turning it back into them anyway.
Right. There's the third lesson. Don't invest in a loser that you know is already a loser. Right?
Yes. That's
yeah.
right. That's right.
Thanks for stopping by, Kevin. This is
no,
awesome.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Kevin.
Yeah, this is great.
All right. So while we're sitting here and waiting for somebody else, David, our guest host, why don't you tell us about your worst investment?
You know, it's kind of hard because after listening to those, I kind of have some similar stories. I think one of my worst investments was back when I first started working in financial services. I worked for what then was 20th Century Mutual Funds, now is American Century. I was 27, 28 years old, and everybody was like, just put money into your 401k and put it into the most aggressive funds. And they were doing really, really well. And so one year, one of the funds was up 144%. And I was just riding high. I think I was probably like 31, 32. And I had over $100,000 in my 401k, and I was like, this is awesome. I'm going to be able to retire a millionaire by the time I'm 35. You know, I just,
nice.
I kind of had this idea, this expectation that what has happened in the past will happen in the future. You know, I didn't understand that past performance does not indicate future returns.
We all know that one.
Yes. Yeah, that was.
Oh, that's solid. That's solid.
So that was right around 1999 that all of that was happening.
Nice.
So
okay.
We
well
all
done.
Know what happened
well
at
done.
The end of
well
1999,
done.
Early 2000. Same thing that happened to the housing market with 2008. So my $100,000 401k dropped down to, I think it was close to $23,000 because I wasn't paying attention to it. I thought,
ouch.
I've got plenty of time. I'll just ride it out. And so I lost like 75% in 1 year, 1.5 years. And I never recovered from that. And I just to kick myself over and over and over again of what my retirement portfolio would look like had I done some rebalancing of my portfolio and some diversification. So that's probably my biggest lesson is diversification and rebalancing.
That's awesome. Well, I mean, it's not awesome that, you know.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
It's not awesome that you suck, but. You know.
It's great for our listeners.
It's a great lesson for our listeners. You know, once again, like Kevin's story, I mean, I think one of the things is we get caught up in this idea that, like, we have to have a big winner. We have to have this big thing. And we have to, you know, do these massive things. But the reality is it's like, it's those everyday things, those small things that, like, add up to making a big difference. And so paying attention to things like that make a huge difference in the long run.
Absolutely. There's another podcaster that we listen to who's not in the personal finance space, but his slogan is little by little, a little becomes a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, all of the little things that we do on a daily basis, whether it's saving or spending or the financial decisions that we make, compound. And it's not just money that compounds, it's decisions that compound, it's lack of action that compounds as well. And so I think that's why it's so important to reflect on our mistakes that we've made and try to learn from some others like ours.
Our next guest here is Steve Stewart. He is the famous Steve Stewart. He is actually our podcast producer. So
he is the Grayson Bell of podcasting.
That's right.
He makes us look good.
He does. He makes us sound deliciously wonderful. So, Steve, we would love you to tell us what is your worst investment, Steve?
Well, mine's pretty small, but it was because I didn't know what I was doing. And I think it was more of a cost in time than actual money.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, it was right after 9/11. My wife and I were going to stick it to the terrorists by investing in the market. And we took a whole bunch of good money and we put it into I think back then it was DataTech, which then was TD Ameritrade or something like that. And
okay.
We took a whole bunch of money, all $500, and bought Boeing stock and this thing called Visage. Visage was like $10 a share. That went nowhere. It actually dropped. And the Boeing was great. I held on to that, except for the fact that they charge like $10 a month if you don't have like $12,000 invested every month.
Interesting.
I didn't see that in the fine print. So that's the money thing. But after keeping the Boeing stock for so long, it's like always watching the market. And it just got to be a bigger investment in time. So there are good lessons that came from it. And maybe that's not a big investing mistake, but I think the lessons that come from it are what's most important.
And I think that's a huge thing to point out. I mean, it's like, first of all, with the Boeing, I assume you were doing the direct investment.
Well, no, again, we bought through
DayTech
or whatever. And
oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Eventually did get a stock certificate. I actually had it printed and that cost $75.
Oh. Wow. Well done.
Yeah. To get it and then to get it back, right?
Exactly.
It cost you to get it. And then when you put it back in, they also charge you.
Yep.
We have some real estate for you in Florida.
Great.
Thank you so much for sharing. Hey, JD.
Just one investing mistake?
Well, pick one. Pick your favorite.
Okay, so...
Well, first of all, let's tell us who you are.
My name is JD Roth. I'm from getrichslowly.org, not .com. Don't go there. So back in the day, I didn't invest. I was like a gambler. And so I would like look at whatever stock was down. Like Countrywide Financial, I remember. I invested in Countrywide. It was crashing.
Well done, sir.
Yes.
Yeah. Well
during
done.
The financial meltdown.
Falling Knives.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly. Falling Knives. And another one was Sharper Image. I had a friend who worked at Sharper Image, and he was an engineer there. And he's like, oh, yeah, the stock is down, but I've been buying it. And this it was like under $2 at this point. I'm like, well, if Andrew's buying it, I should buy it too. And I bought it, and very shortly, the company went bankrupt. So... basically, in both cases, I lost my entire Roth IRA contribution for the year.
Oh, well wow. done, sir. Well done. Wow. And JD here is exhibit one for why I'm an indexer and not a stock picker, everybody.
Yeah, exactly. Same for me. I'm an indexer now, too.
Well done. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, you're welcome.
Adios.
Great.
Okay.
I have a few, which I'll actually try to only choose one. I invested in a Chinese coal company a number of years ago.
Oh,
and,
okay.
You know, always a little curious about foreign companies because, you know, we don't have the same standards.
Yeah.
And, you know,
right.
He's like, I don't know, I'm a little risk averse. But I had a friend that actually went over there. They interviewed the executives. They talked to people. They saw the operations. They went through everything. Everything was on the up and up. And then a few months later, we start to see there was a report out by a short seller. Then they make money, you know, selling these reports.
Yeah.
And it was like, this company is worth nothing. It was like, okay, well, these people come out all the time and say that.
Right.
Sometimes it's true, sometimes it's not. And I was like, but I know a guy who's been there. He's seen everything. He's met the people. It exists because there was these speculations. These companies didn't exist. The company existed. Well, come to find out, shortly after they actually stopped trading the stock, which was interesting in itself, they decided to tell us, oh, by the way, the company took all of the shares and gave it to a private equity firm as collateral to borrow money.
Oh.
And they didn't tell anybody. So effectively, all the shares in the U.S. that were traded were worthless. Yeah. The company was still valid, but the shares you owned were worthless. And it's not something that normal investors could have found. Even if you read through the documents, they didn't tell anybody about
it. Right, yeah.
So my lesson outside of don't invest in Chinese stocks is, is the risk can appear in places that you're not familiar. You could go through all of the numbers, all of the SEC filings. You could do all of your diligence. And you could get, you know, messed over by a minor detail with a company that didn't follow the rules and didn't do what they should. Now, you can try to sue them, but they're in China.
Right.
Good luck.
Right.
I'm sure they're not going to extradite this guy to the U.S. to stand trial, right? So if I was to invest in Chinese stocks, which there's nothing wrong with them, I would do it through an index now because the index will mitigate a lot of those risks because while there are companies over there, and there have been a lot of them, that have been frauds or, you know, scandals of some sort, there are many companies that are not. And I think if you want to invest in China, if you do it through an index, you're mitigating those risks by spreading it out through a lot of the larger companies. You know, they've got some really large companies in China that are most likely not frauds. So you need to understand that the risks, you can't mitigate them all. You just have to understand where they are. And that's my lesson for that.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And you kind of bring up a little something when you're talking about like investing in other countries or investing in other, you know, places like that. I mean, I like the idea of geographic diversity. David talked a little bit about diversifying. Geographic diversity is a thing. And, you know, they have global indices. So you can like find a global index. You can find an emerging market index.
Right.
So you can find these other indexes that you can invest in and get that kind of diversity and that geographic diversity and make a huge difference later on.
So we haven't heard yours.
Oh, no.
Come on, Miranda. Everybody's got a confession here.
Come on.
Well, like so many others, mine's super boring. My problem is since I'm so boring, I think a lot of it just has to do with places where, like when I first started investing, when I first started putting things into an IRA, I actually did it through my insurance agent. So, you know, my insurance agent was like, oh, yeah, we can set you up with a retirement account. We'll set you up with a Roth IRA. We'll get some great funds for you. We'll help you choose your funds. And we had loads. We had high fees. We had like, we had all the things. It was not quite an annuity, thank goodness.
You had everything but performance, right?
Right, yeah, everything but performance. Fantastic. So I think that's probably one of my biggest things is like I didn't understand, and so I kind of trusted the wrong person, right?
Yeah.
I mean, your insurance agent is great when you want to buy insurance. Your insurance agent is not awesome when you want to make investments. So yeah, I mean, if you want to make investments, talk to a professional like Kirk or index, you know, at the very least, index. So that's kind of mine too, is like I kind of trust the wrong person. I didn't think about fees. I didn't understand how that worked. And so I ended up losing quite a lot of performance. And it went away, you know, and then of course the market drops. And so now you've still got to pay all the fees. And so it's eroding all the fees and the market's dropping and the performance isn't great and it's not, you know, doing what it should. So really taking a step back, and while fees aren't everything, it is something to consider.
Absolutely.
Nice. So I have one last bad investment. I actually have quite a few I can talk about, but given the time they've allotted us here, I will say this one, and this will probably have a lot of people turn off the podcast, but I'll say it anyway. One of the worst investments I think that I've made is in college.
Ooh,
oh, wow.
Interesting. Yeah.
So think about college as an investment, right? Nowadays, you spend $250,000 or whatever the costs are today, and are you going to make your money back, right? What's your ROI in college?
ROI? Right. Yeah.
You know, I look at that and say, you know, I had a good college experience. I learned some stuff. Did I learn, I don't know what the amount was, let's say $250,000. You know, did I learn $250,000 worth? I would say no. I mean, my profession, I didn't need a college degree to do it. It helped, right? It you know, it wasn't necessary, right? If I was a doctor, it would be necessary, and getting that background would be helpful. But for normal college, for most people, I think colleges have got to the point where they're so expensive where you're actually not getting a positive ROI from your college investment. And I think that's a real problem, and it's a societal problem that we need to talk about.
I absolutely agree with you. It's a big discussion in our Career Money Facebook group. We've had this discussion before about whether or not there are other opportunities that you could be taking advantage of that could actually, in the long run, net you more money. You'd be able to start investing earlier, putting money into a 401k or into a Roth IRA, those kinds of things. You do potentially lose out on the opportunity cost because you're spending so much time paying that money back. I think one of the other big investments in college is people are investing in lifestyle, not necessarily in education today, because they're spending all this money on things besides the actual education.
Yeah. That's a really good point.
Kegs are not cheap.
No. So thank you so much, David, for joining us. David from Debt Free Guys and also the Queer Money Podcast.
Yes, thank you for having me. It's been fun.
And remember that you need to go ahead and subscribe to us. You can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, Stitcher, and everywhere else fine podcasts are sold. Also, check us out at moneytreepodcast.com for old episodes, new posts, and all the latest on investing. And remember, no one will take care of your money as well as you do, so invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.
Well, I think that's a good point, too, when you talk about... never mind, that's my train of thought. Steve's going to fix it later.
He's going to fix your train of thought? I was like, wow, I need Steve.
Yeah, I need a Steve in my life.